When we share someone's story here on the Diaries, the episode might end, but their story doesn't. So many of the people we've talked to, they've gone on to do incredible things. They have epic adventures and make significant impacts in our community. Over on Diaries Plus, we're catching up with some of our former guests to see what they've been up to. I recently sat down with Connor Ryan, a Lakota professional skier from our Sacred Slopes episode, who's been knocking out groundbreaking projects ever since the episode aired. It's really incredible. We had a great discussion about the impacts he's made, what keeps his fire burning, and taking ski lessons as a pro skier. Here's a snippet of the conversation.
All the source of joy that I use to fill my cup to be out in the world doing positive things comes from my relationship to the outdoors. And so I really focused on like, wow, like there's so much power if I can give one person the relationship to the outdoors that I have through skiing. And maybe that will have as profound of an effect on them as it's had on me.
To listen to the full episode, use the link in the show notes to subscribe to Diaries Plus today. Yeah, you get more shows, but you also have a peace of mind of powering what's out there right now, keeping us moving forward, keeping this community together. So thank you for everyone who supported and everyone who's going to support. We appreciate it. Is this thing on? I've got the studio to myself. Cordelia is out for a few weeks working on an incredible musical that she wrote and is directing. That's pretty cool. Good luck, Cord. Break a leg, as they say. So I just got back from a week of backcountry skiing up in the Monashee Mountains in British Columbia. It was the kind of trip where, you know, a bunch of friends get flown up into the deep mountains. There's a small kind of cabin that you can live in with some, you know, bunk beds. And then you spend a week exploring the range on skis. You know, on nice days, you get to ski to the top of mountains and ski off of them. It's pretty cool. And usually this trip is feels like a lock, like everyone's chomping at the bit to go on it. But this year was different because, you know, back in December, the world was still felt like it was upside down. I don't know if it feels any less upside down now, but it felt particularly upside down. And the idea of sort of putting down money on a trip that may or may not happen, it was just a difficult pill to swallow because it felt like it probably wasn't going to happen. But we ended up making the commitment. And a lot of us didn't know each other. There were friends of friends on the trip. I didn't know what to expect. It was all guys. That can kind of be intense sometimes. And when we showed up, we had like a meeting to kick it all off. And people were like, you know, what do you want to do? It was like, ski every day till dark. You know, I want to be ground into dust. It was like that kind of thing. And I think the deepest anyone got on their goals for the trip was like, I want to laugh a lot. But a funny thing happened. We were out, and maybe it was the fact that none of us thought that the trip would actually happen. Maybe it was the fact that we're coming out of 2 years of pandemic living. Maybe it was the fact that we're maybe getting a little bit older and have less to prove. But the pace on the skin track slowed down enough to allow for good conversation. Typically, like, I feel like everyone's just kind of like breathing super hard. And I heard stories from friends that I've known for years that I never heard before. And those conversations on the skin track, they carried back to the cabin, and we were offered real windows into the not always like pretty things, the struggles and fears and worries that each of us had experienced at different stages of our life. And it was followed up with a lot of laughter, but it was a powerful thing. And I think sometimes that's what is incredible about the outdoors is, yes, you want to go to the top of a mountain and ski off it. Yeah, you want to come back to the takeout. You know, we set the goals, we take physical risks, we take mental risks, but it's also it can set the stage where if you let it and you listen and you slow down a little bit, you can learn so much from the people that you're with. So today, we have a story about a remarkable adventure through the heart of Central Canada's maze of water and woodlands. Two young friends found themselves accepting a unique responsibility, guiding a 78-year-old retired wildlife biologist in the final stages of Parkinson's for one last trip down Manitoba's Blood Vein River. The trip opened a window into the power of the human spirit, partnership, and love that neither one will forget. I'm Fitzka Hall. Producer Stephanie Malterich brings us the story. You're listening to the Dirtbag Diaries.
I got into paddling because of my dad. My dad is an avid canoeist. And so I think my first canoe trip, I was probably 3 years old, still in diapers. And every summer since then, I've been canoeing all over northwestern Ontario and Manitoba. And then when I was about maybe 14 or 15, I got into whitewater kayaking. So it was a high school teacher that introduced me to the sport. And that sort of changed the trajectory of my life. I've been chasing wild rivers all over Canada ever since.
This is Stephen Walker. Stephen is out on the water pretty much every month of the year, even in Winnipeg, where the average low temperature in January is a frigid -1 degree Fahrenheit. Stephen estimates he's in his boat between 60 to 100 days each year. And although his interests have shifted from multi-day canoe trips to whitewater kayaking, he's recently figured out a way to combine his love for both.
In more recent years, I've really been fascinated with expedition-style whitewater kayaking. So chartering float planes into remote areas in northern Canada and then paddling wild class 4 or 5 rivers back to civilization.
Colin Gissiger is Stephen's oldest friend and trusted kayaking partner. The two met playing Little League baseball, and in high school, they started kayaking together.
Some of our initial kind of really wild, crazy adventures we shared were whitewater kayaking on the North Shore of Lake Superior. So we'd go early spring right after school ended, and we'd run all kinds of really challenging whitewater on the North Shore of Lake Superior there, kind of in the Thunder Bay, Duluth area. And the two of us have shared some wild times through injuries, through sort of scary experiences. I've kind of forged a friendship that's a little more like brotherhood than friendship.
About 3 years ago, Stephen, Colin, and two other friends completed a paddling expedition that ended on the North Shore of Lake Athabasca. The group of four drove 3 days to Stony Rapids, Saskatchewan, about 50 miles south of Canada's Northwest Territories.
So we drove there, which is, just about the wildest road, one of the wildest roads in Canada, I think. That's pretty crazy. And then we were in a four-wheel drive truck all the way up there, and then we got in a float plane from Stony Rapids.
From there, they loaded their kayaks, gear, and food that would last a week onto a float plane and took off for the headwaters of the Old Man River. They spent 6 days navigating the river while making first descents on rowdy waterfalls along the way. Despite scouring maps and satellite images beforehand, the area turned out to be more wild and more remote than they anticipated. Many rapids were unrunnable. They struggled to drag kayaks through the dense boreal forest, and they spent many days fending off mosquitoes. But overall, the trip was a success.
Yeah, we're sort of the first whitewater kayakers to navigate quite a few of those challenging waterfalls and canyons.
The four paddlers eventually made it to Lake Athabasca, but the trip didn't end there. An extreme storm descended on the lake, and the group fought huge waves as they struggled to kayak to the shore.
When we got to Lake Athabasca, we had initially lined up a boat shuttle pickup. We spent 2 days waiting for a boat that didn't seem to be coming. And so, and every single kayaking trip, we have the same discussion where it's like, should we pack an extra meal or two in case we get stranded? And we always say, nah, it'll be okay. And sure enough, that trip, we spent 2 days looking at each other, wishing we had packed that extra meal until a friend of mine caught a fish and we ate that. Yeah, it was definitely an added part to the adventure, the last 2 days there, sitting on the beach waiting.
After two long days, the shuttle boat arrived at the lake and transported the group and their boats back to Stony Rapids. These kinds of trips and experiences have laid the foundation of Stephen and Colin's strong friendship.
Yeah, Colin's one of those people that kind of no matter what, doesn't matter how, it's like there's that kind of like type 1 fun and type 2 fun. Doesn't matter what kind of fun it is, Colin is always game and doesn't ever complain.
In the spring of 2020, Stephen and Colin were presented with an opportunity that would challenge their idea of adventure and what they thought possible. But it wasn't a whitewater kayaking expedition. Their favorite college professor, Jill Oakes, approached them and asked if they would help guide her husband, Rick Rewey, who was 78 years old, on a bike tour across Europe.
So Rick was a wildlife biologist by trade. And so he was from Detroit, Michigan to begin with, and he moved to Canada in his kind of mid-20s. And I think ever since he was a kid, he was fascinated with Canada and especially the Canadian Arctic. So when he came here to do his master's, he was up in northern Canada and fell in love with the vast wilderness and the people of the north.
Rick and Jill's careers as professors sent them down a path of exploration and discovery. Rick spent much of his time traveling throughout the Canadian Arctic and northern Russia by bush plane or boat. He studied wildlife and stayed in igloos and caribou skin tents while traveling with hunters and studying Inuit traditional ways of life. Jill was an anthropologist who studied Inuit clothing, and her ability to fly small planes opened doors for the couple to explore. When Stephen and Colin met Rick, he had already been living with an aggressive form of Parkinson's disease for nearly 10 years. Although medical treatment wasn't available to manage the disease, Rick's doctor explained that some research found that daily activity and movement could slow its progress.
And so Jill and Rick kind of took that to heart and for many years had been cycling all over the place all the time to just keep Rick moving. From the way Jill sort of explained it to us, it's that if you don't use it, you lose it. So he'd cycled across the U.S. twice. They've cycled all over North America. They were cycling every single day, all the time. They're riding not just short distances. They were riding like 80 to 100 kilometers a day all the time. Despite their efforts, there was still a slow progression. They definitely slowed that trajectory. And Rick was, in those early days, given just a few years to live and long surpassed that.
While enrolled at the University of Manitoba, rumor spread that Jill taught fascinating classes focused on the Canadian Arctic. So Stephen and Colin enrolled in every single course Jill taught, and they were blown away by her lessons and stories. And Jill was equally fascinated by the pair. She noticed once school let out, the two were packing their bags and taking off to live in tents to do all kinds of wild things during summer break. Early on in 2020, Jill announced in class that she was seeking support from a student to help her and Rick on an upcoming bike trip. Colin immediately went up to Jill after class.
And she mentioned it to him, and he was gung-ho, and I think he knew I would be gung-ho as well, so we signed up the moment we could. And I think we were both always looking for the next adventure and always looking for the next thing, and I think we were both at that precipice where we're about to graduate, and there's sort of maybe this pressure to get an office job or get a 9-to-5. And I think when this opportunity presented itself where we could be out adventuring all the time, traveling all over the place, I think it was a pretty easy call.
But the adventure would look different than those of the past. It was a job. And the job was to help Jill keep Rick moving in his final days.
They talked a lot about this is sort of Rick's medicine. And staying active, staying moving is like the secret to Rick's health. It was pretty clear that like every day, rain or shine, we were going to be out and about cycling or staying moving. She was like very clear that it was just like 7 days a week we were going to be going for it. And there's one thing to kind of note about Jill and Rick is like those two, they adventure all day, every single day. And so that means like up at the crack of dawn and adventure till 5 or 6 until the end of the day kind of thing. And they don't go slowly. So it's full throttle all the time.
The job with Rick came with a grave reality. No one knew how much longer he would live. This was new for Stephen, who hadn't thought about mortality or death much at all.
Yeah, I think when Jill hired us, she was pretty clear that day would come at any time, you know, and that they were sort of living on borrowed time. And that was very much something that we were aware of from the very get-go. The whole thing about death and talking about it is definitely something that Colin and I were not used to, and was definitely something I don't think we really probably didn't fully comprehend at the time. But as we got to know Rick and as we worked through the summer and saw things changing, I think we were doing our best to kind of prepare for that at any time. But it's a hard concept to wrap your head around in those, especially when you've never kind of experienced that sort of thing before.
The group planned to spend 4 months biking across Europe. But as the pandemic escalated in the spring, the bike trip was quickly derailed. As flights were canceled, Stephen, Colin, Rick, and Jill shifted their plans to stay within the borders of Manitoba. They biked all around the province from border to border, but it didn't take them long to exhaust nearly all of their trail options on the roads and trails around Manitoba. So they started to brainstorm new ideas to keep Rick active. River trips were Stephen and Colin's expertise, and Rick and Jill had spent many vacations paddling remote rivers before his Parkinson's diagnosis. So they decided to spend 2 weeks canoeing the Blood Vein River.
The Blood Vein River is, located on the east shore of Lake Winnipeg. I guess you would call that somewhat kind of northern Manitoba. It's a pretty undeveloped area of wilderness. It's actually called the Pemichioan Aki Wilderness, and it was recently designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site for both natural beauty and cultural significance. And so, yeah, there's no roads within the wilderness area. You access it by floatplane. The river is 225 kilometers. There's about 80 rapids along the way. Some are runnable, some not, so lots of portaging. Most people do it in about 14 days, I'd say. It's a Canadian Heritage River and regarded as sort of like the whitewater canoeing river in Manitoba. So yeah, in some of my travels elsewhere, I've had people from Europe ask about the Blood Vein, and it's kind of like this. I think maybe back in the day, it was in lots of canoeing magazines and that sort of thing.
Despite its reputation, only a handful of groups paddle it each summer. The trip would be Stephen and Colin's first time down the river, and it would be a special experience for Jill and Rick. The couple paddled the Blood Vein 30 years prior. Overall, the Blood Vein is pretty mellow. The rapids don't get much harder than Class 1 or 2. But Stephen and Colin knew the remoteness of the river presented a lot of risk.
And the moment you added like a floatplane drop-off into the mix and really no road access for 14 days, it's definitely extreme. Definitely not something to be taken lightly.
And then there was the challenge of getting Rick through the portages.
When we first met Rick, and through the summer, Rick found it really difficult to walk and hard to talk. And so for Colin and I, the biggest concern was most of the canoe routes in Manitoba involve lots of portaging. For Rick, yeah, finding it difficult to walk. He could walk short distances with Colin and I supporting him on either side. But yeah, just the uneven, rugged terrain of the boreal wilderness was a big concern for Colin and I. So I think before we committed to the Blood Vein, we wanted to just test things out and see how it would go. So we did a few. I think we started with a two-night canoe trip and then did like a four-night canoe trip and just sort of increased a little bit at a time. And then those went okay, and we were tweaking our systems as we went. And then, yeah, we did the Manigatagan, which is about a four-day canoe trip, a little bit of whitewater on that river, and quite a bit of portaging. And then from there, we went to the Blood Vein, which is a pretty big jump. Truth be told, like, Colin and I were quite terrified before we left. I think it was just a lot of responsibility and a lot of unknown. We weren't really sure how things were going to play out.
On their day of departure, they showed up to the small seaplane base in Bicetre, Manitoba, which sits on the edge of the wilderness boundary.
We showed up and got Rick out of the truck and Colin and I supporting him on either side. We sort of shuffled our way to the deck of the floatplane base so we could wait for the plane. And everybody at the base was sort of watching us as we were doing this. When Rick shows up, he kind of makes an entrance, you know? It's sort of, I think people aren't used to seeing, yeah, maybe someone who has a difficult time walking and who is also not in a wheelchair. I think that for a lot of people that was quite interesting. So we shuffled our way across the parking lot and sat Rick down in the chair. And then Colin and I were unloading the truck onto the scale where you weigh everything before you throw it in the plane. And I remember the dock hand was kind of like, it was just Colin and I off to the side. And he was like, "You aren't taking that guy with you, are you?" And we sort of just said, yeah, he's going to show us down the Blood Vein.
Stephen remembers how Rick's eyes lit up when they arrived at the remote floatplane dock. He could tell that Rick couldn't wait to climb into the plane and head into the woods for an extended river trip.
Once we got all the gear weighed, all the gear sorted, the plane showed up to the dock, and that was when sort of the magic of it all started to happen. With Parkinson's, like, Rick would have a hard time talking, but there were moments in time, often when he was like really excited to, whether it be like see an old friend or, yeah, just moments where like, that were highly emotional. Yeah, there's a few glimpses where we could see Rick pre-Parkinson's for brief periods of time. And I think one of those examples was when that plane landed and showed up at the dock. Rick just jumped out of the chair as if he's like really big, start walking down to the dock. No help from Colin and I at all.
Despite the questionable looks from people at the dock, and even though they knew the weeks ahead would present many unpredicted challenges, they kept moving forward.
Once the plane pulled up and Rick was sort of getting in no matter what, you know, he was like getting in before the gear was in there. And so Colin and I were helping him down the floating dock, down the ramp and everything. It's sort of shifting in the waves, and Rick's walking by our side, and the pilot and everyone they're standing back kind of watching us. They have like a small metal ladder that goes up to the fuselage into the door. Colin and I were walking up to the edge, and we were always like 100% of the time kind of problem solving, thinking like, how are we going to get Rick in here? How are we going to get Rick through that door? How are we going to get Rick into the truck? You know, we were always kind of thinking these things through. And so as we're walking down to the float plane, Colin and I think are like both thinking, how are we going to get Rick up this ladder? It's not wide enough for both of us to go up with him. And we were kind of standing on the edge, and Rick, in another one of those moments of like, yeah, excitement and joy, for a few seconds there, Parkinson's didn't matter. And Rick was like in the plane before we were with him. So I think in that moment, it was, even though Colin and I were nervous and afraid of what was to come, I think we, in that moment, knew that we were doing the right thing.
After loading gear into the plane, the group took a short flight to their starting point, Artery Lake, which sits on the border of Manitoba and Ontario, on the traditional lands and waterways of the Anishinaabeg. Once they landed, they unloaded the 17-foot canoe, river kayak, portage packs, and barrels full of food. Stephen could tell the pilot felt uneasy.
The pilot especially was, I think, pretty skeptical, and after he dropped us off, it was sort of an awkward farewell, and I think he was probably thinking in his head that he's going to be picking us up in a few days.
After the break, Stephen, Colin, Rick, and Jill head down the Blood Vein River. Stay with us.
Support for the Diaries comes from Ketone IQ. As I've been getting more and more into longer runs and bike rides, I found myself fighting with my mind. As the miles extend, I feel like my reactions get slower and I make more mistakes, like tripping or falling or just kind of feeling slightly out of sync descending on the bike. On those big days, I've been using Ketone IQ to help my brain keep fueled and sharp. I want to have fun, not bonk. Here's the science. Ketones already exist in your body. When you push up against your boundaries, your body begins to convert stored fat into ketones, which your brain prefers consuming. With Ketone IQ, I feed my brain so my muscles can use the glucose I get from whatever else I eat on the trail. Riders of the Tour de France have been taking the same approach. I am definitely not as fast, but I can apply the same thinking. Give it a try. You save 30% off your first subscription order at ketone.com/dirtbagdiaries. Once again, that's ketone.com/dirtbagdiaries. The link is in the show notes. Please check it out.
Artery Lake is protected by Attakakee Provincial Park on one side and Woodland Caribou Provincial Park on the other. The lake's shoreline is surrounded by near-vertical rock faces and untouched boreal forests. And it's famous for Anishinaabe pictographs that are hundreds of years old. From Artery Lake, they began the 14-day trip down the Blood Vein River. Each day, Stephen and Colin would trade off sitting in the back of the canoe while steering downriver. Jill would sit up front to help paddle, and Rick had a seat tucked into the middle. Whoever wasn't paddling the canoe would kayak ahead to scout the rapids and portages ahead. Once the kayaker spotted the trail to a portage, they'd wait to catch the canoe as it came into shore.
Yeah, Colin and I spent a lot of time deliberating on the side of the river, deciding whether or not, weighing the options, deciding what would be the best course of action. I think because of Rick's condition, we were, yeah, very cautious and probably walked a lot more than you for sure normally would. So it was the portaging that was the most grueling and the most tiring for Colin and I. And maybe some of that decision-making around what to run and what not to run was sort of what we found to be the most mentally exhausting, deciding whether or not that was a good idea to run that with Rick and sort of weighing like the options of sometimes walking was even just as dangerous as running the rapids sometimes, you know, up and down crazy cliffs and through all kinds of crazy debris.
Like most wilderness trips, the group settled into a rhythm. They created systems that made each day, each run of a rapid, and each portage more smooth. But the best method they came up with to get the canoe, kayak, barrels of food, and of course Rick, from one end of the trail to the other, didn't necessarily make things easier.
had a bit of a system going. We would, Colin and I would go first. We'd carry the two packs and a barrel. And as we were walking, we'd scout out the trail and, you know, how we're going to get Rick through there. And then we'd go back for Rick on the rickshaw or sometimes walking, and we'd navigate the course with him, and Jill would then wait with him at the other end, and we'd go back for the canoe. So every portage required 3 trips. So that's definitely, pretty tiring.
Luckily, they had some help getting Rick through the rocky terrain. On the shorter test trips leading up to the Blood Vein, friends of Rick and Jill helped construct a mobile wheelchair to help navigate rocky and uneven terrain.
Sort of the story behind, we would call it Rick's kind of rickshaw. It was, that's sort of what it looked like. It was like developed by these friends of Jill and Rick's who were bike mechanics. And so they sort of built the initial prototype and we tested that out and it was awesome. And then we realized it needed to be beefed up a little more. And so Jill handed it off to her her pilot friends who all build airplanes and are used to working with lightweight aircraft grade aluminum. And they sort of beefed up the construction. And then, that was ultimately what we took in the Blood Vein. So sort of a cool example of like this community of friends supporting them back home who all dedicated time and energy into making this trip possible. Yeah, it sort of like looked sort of like a rickshaw. So it had like these long wheelbarrow-esque handles. So one person would walk in front of it, towing the cart, and Rick would sit in the back, and there was a nice backrest kind of chair, and there would be kind of 20-inch mountain bike tires on either side of Rick.
Rick's rickshaw was multi-purpose. The wheels had quick releases to easily pop off and store in the canoe, and the seat fit nicely in the middle where Rick would sit. After a couple of months together, Stephen understood the many ways Rick expressed himself. Sometimes it was a look in his eyes, his body language, or a simple smile.
Yeah, because Rick didn't speak very often, I think we looked for maybe reassurance that we were doing the right thing in other ways. And so there are quite a few moments through the trip that were sort of magic moments where Rick was kind of smiling or saying a few words of sort of gratitude. And I think those moments are what stick the most. One morning we were on the water extremely early because Rick was always up at the crack of dawn. And we rounded a corner in the river and there was a cow moose kind of waiting in the river. And we just sat silently and watched it. And you could see Rick, he was pointing and just watching it so intently, kind of studying it as it made its way out of the water and stood on the shore and looked at us for a little while and then sort of disappeared into the forest. And I think, for me, that was probably the moment that stands out the most as one of the most memorable, because I think that was an animal Rick had studied during his career and an animal Rick was very passionate about.
With Stephen and Colin paddling the boats and hauling gear, they made an opportunity that may have been impossible for Jill and Rick. For Stephen, it was clear the couple enjoyed the time on the river and with each other.
Pure magic, I think, is the best way to describe that. Rick and Jill, I think, were what you'd call like relationship goals. You know, I think they, the two of them, like after so many years together and through so much, just so in love and so happy with one another and so happy to be there and like so in the moment and just loving every second of it. There were a few times where, you know, that we'd show up to camp and we would be sort of going about our nightly routine, making dinner or filtering water. And we'd be up kind of up on the rock away from the riverbank and you'd just watch Jill and Rick sitting on the riverbank as the sun's kind of setting low. And Jill would be swimming and they'd be chatting and just totally, totally so happy to be there and just so in love.
Their trip down the Blood Vein River ended as they passed through the Blood Vein First Nation out into Lake Winnipeg. The group finished in 10 days, a few days earlier than they'd planned. And despite their pre-trip jitters, the trip finished without incident. Yet Stephen and Colin agree it was the most exhausting trip of their lives to date.
So physically, seriously exhausting. So we would paddle 20 to 30 kilometers a day and it wasn't necessarily the paddling that was challenging, but it was the portaging. Yeah, it was just like the heavy lifting, the serious heat. Kind of, this was a really hot summer in Winnipeg or in Manitoba. And so every night, Colin and I would be so dead. We would be laying on the rock once Rick went to bed, just like completely like unable to move. And every morning wake up with like, you know, stiff, sore backs and rolling around all slowly. And then you'd see Rick up and at it already, ready to go. And it'd be like, wow, if he's ready to rock, I'm too young to be complaining about my back, you know? I should be up there too. So it was definitely good motivation. I think mentally exhausting as well. And I think that was just that decision-making all the time. We were not making decisions for ourselves, but making decisions for Rick and for Rick and Jill, and to make sure that they made it down in one piece and made it down safely. And so every single rapid on the river, Colin and I would be deliberating, weighing the options and deciding how best to get around it. I think it was this thing that wouldn't really be possible without Colin, because, you know, we spent enough time together that we can sort of communicate without talking. And we were sort of operating on this level where we were always thinking and always on the same page and just operating like a well-oiled machine.
Stephen and Colin's time with Rick didn't stop after the canoe trip down the Blood Vein. In fact, the Blood Vein was only one of many adventures the two shared with Rick and Jill in the 8 months they spent working as guides. In typical Rick and Jill fashion, the group only took a few days to recover before packing up for a 30-day bike tour along the Sunshine Coast in British Columbia. Their bike rides continued into the fall and early winter, but Stephen and Colin could tell things were changing for Rick.
At that point, we were back to kind of cycling. It was winter was coming in Manitoba, and we were cycling in the snow all the time and still doing it every day. I think at that point, we could see the trajectory things were on. Yeah, maybe when you're in it, it's hard to see, but looking back, you can see that every month or so, Rick was losing the ability to do a certain thing, you know, and it was small little things, but all sort of trending in a certain direction.
And Rick's health continued to decline. He was eventually admitted to the hospital. When he was released, Stephen could see how a single bedridden week had taken a huge toll on Rick's health.
And that was really when I think we fully understood how important movement was for Rick, because a week in the hospital for Rick was truly so rough on him, to not be moving. By the time he came out of the hospital, he lost the ability to do a lot of things he was doing before that. Pretty heavy. So he came out of the hospital at that point. Things had declined so fast that he came out of the hospital on palliative care with kind of the program that these would be his last few days, and that he was to do what he wanted to do in those last few days. And he was given probably 3 or 4 days to live, and he lived for probably almost 2 weeks. Yeah, we cycled just about every day until about 2 or 3 days before he passed away. We weren't cycling 80 or 100 kilometers, but we were still getting out on the bike and watching things, you know, slowly slow down. But yeah, Rick's spirit and joy for life was there right until the end. So it was pretty crazy, pretty magical.
Rick passed away on November 25th, 2020. From the day Stephen and Colin accepted the job as Rick's guides, they knew this day would come eventually. But of course, it was still a tough reality to face. For the first handful of days, it was hard for Stephen to wake up knowing he wouldn't be heading outside for a day of bike riding with Rick.
For the first time through all the summer, we had some time to reflect, you know, and I think the summer was so go, go, go that I would write in a journal every night, but I wouldn't necessarily be fully grasping what was going on and how things were playing out. We were very much living day to day. And so there was, a lot of time for, to kind of replay some of the memories shared and sort of do some hard thinking on the lessons learned. And I think I'm still doing that to this day. Rick was, you know, ill, terminally ill. But at the same time, seeing someone doing what they love, being active, being engaged out there doing it. It was almost like he was kind of the healthiest person I'd ever met at the same time, you know? Yeah, I think for Colin and I both, that's probably definitely influenced how we're approaching life now and how kind of appreciating moments that we maybe would overlook beforehand. Yeah, it sort of maybe taught me the lesson that adventure is happiness and happiness is health. There's definitely some powerful lessons in that. And I think with the no time to waste, it's quite something when when you sort of know the end is coming. Like, spending a Sunday in bed laying around is sort of hard to justify.
Thank you, Stephen, for sharing your story today. Inspired by Rick and Jill's spirit of exploring the Arctic and Northern Canada, Stephen now works as an environmental consultant in Hudson Bay, and Colin leads remote wilderness canoe trips in Canada's Northwest Territories. Our stories come from friends of friends, and from you, our community. If you have a compelling idea for a guest or a story lead, please give us a shout. You can use the submission form on our website, dirtbagdiaries.com. Music today from John Barry, Publish the Quest, Bradley Carter, Ken Christensen, Kai Engel, and Brennan O'Connell. The tracks are courtesy of the Artists of Free Music Archive. Jacob Bain and Nice Cotto composed our theme song. You can find the links to the artists at our website, dirtbagdiaries.com. This episode was written and produced by Stephanie Malterich, and additional production from Becca Hall and Matt Martin. Illustration by Walker Call, graphics by Anya Miller. Becca Call is our executive producer. I'm Fitz Cahal, and you've been listening to the Dirtbag Diaries. Thanks for tuning in.